Liability case. Patel Law is located at 108 West University Avenue in Urbana with offices in Danville and Decatur. For more information, visit patellawteam.com or call 217-384-1111. Today's Disability Beat is also sponsored by our community partner, Jets Pizza. Jets uses only premium ingredients, including dough made fresh daily. Jets Pizza stores are located at 512 South Neal Street in Champaign. Their number 217-352-3333 and 1907 West Springfield Avenue, and their number is 217-352-9992. You can order online at jetspizza.com. And now stay tuned for Disability Beat.
My name is Micah Nelson Clout. I'm from the Champaign County Regional Planning Commission. You are listening to Disability Beat on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, community radio for East Central Illinois.
This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for an interview with Philip Pauly, Policy and Practices Director for Respectability, a national organization committed to impacting politicians and policy on behalf of people with disabilities. But first, disability news for the week of August 1st, 2016, from Disability Scoop, Inclusion Daily Express, and the Arc of Illinois. Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner vetoed House Bill 4351 last week, legislation which would have protected community-based services for tens of thousands of seniors and people with disabilities. The bill, proposed by Representative Greg Harris of Chicago, would have maintained criteria for the Determination of Needs, or DON, which is used to define eligibility for services for people with disabilities and those who are elderly across the state. According to advocates, this veto is seen as an attempt by the governor to reduce the budget intended to support community services for people with disabilities by allowing the eligibility score to be raised to a level that would eliminate some from qualifying for support. There has already been discussion about a possible override of the veto by members of the House. The U.S. Department of Education has issued guidelines aimed at preventing schools from discriminating against the growing number of students with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. In a letter to school districts and a Know Your Rights document to be posted on its website last week, the department said schools must obey existing civil rights law to identify students with ADHD and provide them with accommodations to help them learn. The guidelines come in response to years of complaints from parents who say that their children have been denied needed services and that schools have failed to protect them from bullying. The Education Department, which has received roughly 2,000 such complaints over the last 5 years, said schools have requested clarification of their responsibilities under the law. The number of children being diagnosed with ADHD, a neurological disorder characterized by impulsivity, hyperactivity, or inattentiveness, has soared over the last decade. The Windows 10 upgrade offer ended yesterday, July 31st. If you still haven't updated to Windows 10, you will have to pay $119 or more to upgrade. However, if you happen to use any assistive technologies, you will still be able to upgrade to it for free. Back in May, Microsoft announced that the company would be offering Windows 10 as a free upgrade to assistive technology users, even after the upgrade offer is gone for everyone else. Microsoft has also launched a website for assistive technology users where they can get more information on how to get the update. After discovering that the drinking water for hundreds of thousands of Texans with disabilities living in state-funded homes contained toxic amounts of lead, state officials waited a month to test the residents for lead poisoning, which may have skewed results. The amount of lead that can be detected in a person's blood typically drops by half after 15 to 30 days. Residents at the state homes have been drinking bottled water since early May, which means the amount of lead that would show up in their blood a month later could be as much as 75% less than when the state first identified the problem. And it pans out to gives reason to the results, which is almost 500 people who were tested for lead intake in those institutions, only 20 of them ended up with elevated lead levels. Excuse me. And finally, with all eyes on the race for the White House, both political parties are calling for big change to rules on employing people with disabilities. The platforms approved this month at both the Democratic and Republican Party conventions are both urging a move toward competitive employment. Currently, under a federal law dating back to the 1930s, employers are able to get special permission from the U.S. Department of Labor to pay people with disabilities less than the federal minimum wage of $7.25 per hour. Now, however, the political winds appear to be shifting. The Democrats' agenda, ratified last week at the convention in Philadelphia, reads, quote, "We support creating one fair wage for all workers by ending the sub-minimum wage for tipped workers and people with disabilities," end quote. The plan echoes comments made by the party's presidential nominee Hillary Clinton earlier this year on the campaign trail. Meanwhile, the GOP also signaled its support for similar changes in the platform approved at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland 2 weeks ago. The Republicans stated, quote, "Our TIME Act, or Transition to Integrated and Meaningful Employment, will modernize the Fair Labor Standards Act to encourage competitive employment for persons with disabilities. We endorse efforts like Employment First that replace dependency with jobs in the mainstream of the American workforce," end quote. The TIME Act is a proposal in Congress that would bar the Labor Department from issuing new certificates allowing the payment of subminimum wage and would phase out the use of existing certificates within 3 years. Since it was introduced in 2015, the legislation has failed to gain much traction, said Mark Riccobono, president of the National Federation of the Blind, which supports an end to subminimum wage. Quote, "The recognition of this issue by leaders of both political parties further confirms that the time has long passed to eliminate the unfair and separate wage system for people with disabilities," end quote. And that's the news for this week.
Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. The woman done left and took the reason that I've been working for. Don't you try and stop. I wanna walk right out that door. You can take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. Well, I've been working in this factory for now on 15 years. I've seen that woman of mine drowning in a pool of tears.
And you are listening to WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM. This is Disability Beat. I'm Vicki Nicewander, and I'm joined today by a guest on the phone. This is Philip Pauly, who is the Policy and Practices Director of Respectability, a national organization that you're going to be learning more about today. Welcome to the program, Philip.
Good afternoon, Vicki, and I'm absolutely delighted to be with you today. Very excited for our conversation, and we've got a lot to talk about.
Yes, we do. Well, first of all, why don't you introduce yourself to the listeners and kind of give folks a sense of who you are and your connection to the world of disability issues, and then you can talk a little bit about Respectability as an organization.
Well, first and foremost, I want to take it back to my childhood, naturally enough. I'm originally from out west in Denver, Colorado, and I spent more than a fair few summers up on my godparents' farm up in Cheyenne, Wyoming. And my godparents were very involved in raising me, and my godmother was a wonderful woman by the name of June Harvey. She actually had polio. She contracted it as a little girl and got by her entire life on crutches and in a wheelchair. And she never let that stop her. She actually had a 40-year career in the financial services sector and got to really live the American dream. And that was my first real exposure to, you know, seeing a person with a disability who was really successful in their life. And that was kind of the baseline image I always had of what people were capable of achieving. And, you know, it took me a lot longer to realize that that was not a common experience and that she was really one of the lucky ones. A lot of my closest friends growing up in Colorado were on the spectrum, on the autism spectrum to one degree or another. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've stayed very close with them over the years, and some of them are really succeeding and others are really struggling. And lastly, my mother actually has her own chronic illnesses that she has to deal with. So the life I've lived has been, you know, touched by disability as a child growing up and now in the work that I do. The work that I do as the Policy and Practices Director for Respectability is I'm responsible for advancing our policy agenda. So I do research, I write about issues impacting employment for people with disabilities, I give presentations at conferences about workforce development challenges, I work with governors, state leaders, educate them about the opportunities and challenges facing the 1 in 5 Americans who have disabilities, and I've been working for Respectability a year and a half now.
And how long has Respectability been an organization?
We are now 3 years old. Mm-hmm. We were launched in 2013 as a continuation of the work being done by Delaware Governor Jack Markell. Back in 2012, Markell was elected as the chair of something called the National Governors Association. And that organization, when they pick a new chair for the year, that governor gets to pick a particular issue that they get to work on. And the issue that he chose was employment for people with disabilities. As the governor of Delaware, he's worked very hard to get more people with disabilities opportunities to get jobs, to get training, to complete their education, to overcome a lot of the attitudinal barriers that keep them out of the workforce. And after he was done with his year at the NGA, they had developed a lot of work and a lot of ideas and a lot of best practices about how to really expand opportunity, and yet the way the NGA works is it moves on to a new topic the following year. And my boss, Jennifer Laszlo Mizrahi, saw a real golden opportunity to really move the needle in terms of jobs for people with disabilities. She saw that there was kind of a window of opportunity to impact Democrats, Republicans, the coming presidential race, to really get the issue of disability as a topic of national conversation. She herself is a person with a disability. She's significantly dyslexic growing up, so she knows the very personal barriers that can be caused by an invisible disability. And she is also the parent of 2 children with her own significant disability issues. And so she brought her experience as a political operative, as someone who's worked on nonprofits, to really kind of create a new organization that would be really focused on, you know, really driving the needle by advancing best practices, by educating leaders, and by building coalitions to really change the world.
Sounds wonderful. So how much involvement have you had as an organization with this TIME Act that I talked about in the news today?
One of the important things is that Respectability, we are not a lobbying group. We're an advocacy and education nonprofit. Mm-hmm. So we don't go to Congress and say, you know, you should really vote for this bill. We don't lobby, you know, certain bills to get passed. However, we act as a resource. We go to Capitol Hill every couple of months. We meet the staffers. We meet with people in Congress. We tell them, these are the issues facing the community. Here's some data. Here are the challenges. And here's what you should need to know about it. So, for example, we work very closely at the state level with governors to kind of implement policies, pass executive orders, to get them to move towards, for example, employment first policies. So we don't lobby, but we do advocate and we educate, and we work very hard to have an impact. Actually, we are, as an example, the impact we have is coming up on August 8th. We are actually hosting a special disability and politics training seminar on Capitol Hill. Hmm. We're inviting political consultants, campaign staff, and people from the community to talk about how to get more Americans with disabilities involved in the political process, from social media to registering to vote to getting out and organizing.
Yeah, we talked about this on the show a couple weeks ago about the fact that, you know, we really work hard to get families and people with disabilities to lobby and get to know their legislators so that they can have influence. But one thing that the disability community seems to be missing is the money. And of course, money is power on Capitol Hill. So, you know, what advice do you give to people who don't have, you know, big money to donate but want to have an influence?
Honestly, there's no easy solution to that. But the way I think about it is that people do have a really incredible resource. They have their time. And, you know, people, it's very easy to get involved with politics. And beyond just registering to vote, you can tweet, you can write op-eds, put them in your local newspaper. You can reach out to candidates running for local offices, or state-level offices. You can go to their events, and if there's a Q&A session, you can ask them, what are you going to do to help people with disabilities? We saw in Iowa and New Hampshire a lot of folks from the disability community get organized and go to town halls, to go to campaign rallies, and get themselves in front of a microphone and ask the candidate a question. And that kind of visibility is very important. And yes, you're not a lobbyist in Congress. You're not in one of the smoke-filled rooms. But if you get out there, get your voice heard, if you get enough people and get enough of their voices heard, it's going to have an impact.
And, you know, I don't know many people as a whole in the community as a whole that aren't touched by disability in some way, if not their immediate family, a friend, or even themselves that are impacted by it. So it doesn't seem like it should be that hard of a sell. But
no, ma'am.
It turns out that it really is, because how long has it taken to make any progress on this issue? It's been a long time.
I mean, the Americans with Disabilities Act is 26 years old, and it was a 10-year-long fight to get it even passed. As Justin Dart, who is obviously one of the great guiding lights of the disability rights movement, said, you know, get involved with politics because your life depends on it. And
Absolutely. Something
you're talking about, how disability impacts everyone. One of the first things we did in 2013 was to do a poll, a nationwide poll of the disability community, and we got over 3,000 respondents, and we looked at registered voters, Democrats, Republicans, people in the community, people not involved in politics, and we found that 51% of registered voters either had a disability or had a loved one with a disability, and we had about, you know, partisanship broke down right across the kind of the American spectrum. We had, you know, a solid group of registered voters with disabilities who were Republicans, Democrats, and Independents. And so, as you say, disability impacts everybody to one degree or another. And more now, with this election cycle, we're getting that voice out there, and people are starting to pay attention.
So if I'm an ignorant legislator, and, you know, when you go to see a legislator on Capitol Hill, if you get 5 minutes, you're lucky, mm-hmm. right? So what do you say when you walk in the door? Give people some hints on how to approach this.
Ooh.
Not to put you on the spot or anything, Phil.
No. As you say, time is money, and time is very valuable, and you're not going to really have that much time. The kind of personal approach I have to make meeting with a legislator to begin with is, and this is a piece of advice from one of my board of directors, is you should really limit yourself to 30 minutes of small talk, 30 seconds of small talk. It's very important when you're in trying to influence the legislator that you get right to the point. You should be polite and you should be nice. You should be respectful, but you should get down to business because their time is valuable and they'll appreciate that. In terms of like gauging the knowledge of that someone has or not, I kind of start again talking about, as you were saying, how disability impacts everybody. They start by talking about how one in five Americans has a disability. And if you're talking with, say, a state legislator, you know, you want to talk about how many people with disabilities live in your state and what types of disabilities they have. And as an example of how you can get that information, you can go to our website, which is respectabilityusa.org, go to our policymakers page, and you can download data on your state and talk and learn about how many people are blind, how many people are deaf, and the types of challenges that people in the community are facing in your state.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to, you know, tell them what are the facts, how does this impact you, and what you want them to do about it. You know, honestly, getting them paying attention to it and getting somebody to think about disability in a new way is very important.
And I would think the other goal of that conversation is you want that legislator to remember to call you when they have questions about issues that come up.
Yes. And you have to build the relationship, which takes time, as with everything you do. And you want to be a resource, which is why, for example, with respectability, we've worked very hard to be very nonpartisan, because we've deliberately cultivated relationships with Republican leaders and Democratic leaders so that they would come to us with questions and we could direct them to where they can find the answer. And if you yourself don't have the answer, you should know the organization that does. So, for example, I'm not as deeply involved in, say, home and community-based service issues as other organizations are. But if I get a call from somebody on the Hill with a question about what HCDF means for people with disabilities, I know to pick up the phone and call NICL, which is the National Council on Independent Living, or the Autism Self Advocacy Network.
Right. So what organizations do you collaborate with in Washington?
Well, I'll give you an example of our collaborative work. Last year, we worked on something called the Disability Employment First Planning Toolkit, which was a compilation of kind of the best policies and lessons learned, best practices that we want to see more and more states adopting to expand employment opportunities for people with disabilities. And so to put together that document, we built consensus working with the National Council of Independent Living, the National Organization on Disability, the National Association of Councils on Developmental Disabilities, Best Buddies International, and Paralyzed Veterans of America. They've been kind of our core group of partners, and they work with us on policy issues, legislative issues, and many of those organizations have state affiliates, which allow us to kind of reach very far and wide. I am also very involved with something called the CCD, which is the umbrella group of all of the major disability organizations. And I work with them on their task force, collaborating on sending comments on proposed regulations or sending Dear Colleague letters to people on the Hill. And, for example, with our work in the early primary states, we built on the ground kind of a coalition of local partners who had questions that they wanted the presidential candidates to answer. And so working together with a large group of organizations, we put together a questionnaire that we have sent to every single presidential campaign. Bernie Sanders filled it out. Hillary Clinton filled it out. Quite a few Republicans filled it out. And to date, the only campaign which has not filled out our questionnaire is the Trump campaign, but not for lack of trying. And those questions on that questionnaire came from the community and really addressed, you know, very personal issues ranging from medical marijuana to home and community-based services, transportation.
Yeah, and I did hear her address subminimum wage at one point. She continues to talk about that and seems to be gradually getting better in her ability to express that. I mean, it started out, I thought, you know, she maybe didn't really have quite a handle on the issue, but as we get further into the campaign, she seems to be understanding it better and better.
Oh, yes. And, you know, there are, you know, there are Facebook groups of people who are, you know, working and coordinating volunteering opportunities with campaigns. And, you know, getting out there and getting involved is fundamentally how we as a community can get our issues heard.
Right. So you have put a lot of work into issues around employment, for sure, and issues of getting people with disabilities and family members out to vote and to support those candidates who understand and support disability issues. What's some of the other work that you're doing? Because I think I read something about mass incarceration and how people with disabilities are included in that number. Is there others that one of your areas that you work on, and what else do people need to know about respectability?
Well, I'll get to the criminal justice stuff in just a moment, but going back to kind of our core mission, the way we see it is we're about embracing disability and advancing opportunity. Mm-hmm. And one of the most important ways to do that is to bust the stigmas that are associated with people with disabilities. There's still too many myths and misconceptions about what it means to be a person with a disability. And so one of the ways we're fighting that is by getting involved with Hollywood. We've been very involved with the production of a television show on A&E called Born This Way.
Oh, yes.
Season 2 just premiered last week. Mm-hmm. We've helped out with, you know, getting recruiting cast and pushing it out on social media. And I would encourage everyone to watch the show. You can catch the first season online at A&E.com. And second season is now premiering Tuesday nights at 10 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about the lives and loves of young people with Down syndrome. And it's really groundbreaking and currently nominated for 3 Emmy Awards. So get out there and watch it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on the less happy side is the issue of criminal justice reform. And, you know, here in Washington, D.C., it's one of the big issues where Democrats and Republicans are still having substantive conversations. And the reason why is very clear. The United States is home to 5% of the world's population, but we actually have 25% of the world's prison population. And this actually comes out to a taxpayer bill of $80 billion a year. And so you have this kind of consensus emerging between liberals and conservatives. People are concerned about disparities of racial justice, and people are concerned about the cost to the taxpayer, kind of really coming together and finding common ground and finding ways to reform sentencing procedures, to create alternative sentencing.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a kind of a very much an ongoing conversation. And several months ago, for National Reentry Week, Respectability was invited to go to some White House events where they were talking about the economic cost of the criminal justice system. And at every single one of the conversations, disability was absent.
Hmm.
And so it wasn't raised in the conversation. And if it was, they said, oh, yeah, people in prison have mental health issues. And so in response to what we felt is really a significant lack of knowledge and an absence of the conversation, we reached out to a large number of other organizations and began working on a report detailing the challenges and opportunities involved with people with disabilities who have ended up in the criminal justice system. And the numbers are really staggering. When it breaks down, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, 32% of people in prison and 40% of people in jail are people with disabilities. And so that comes out to, by our estimate, about 750,000 people with disabilities who are behind bars.
Mm-hmm. Because the mental health system can't handle it. They don't know what to do, or they don't put the money into it to handle that kind of, to help people rather than to lock them up.
Exactly. And there's another issue with it. And you hear a lot of people who talk about criminal justice issues, who talk about rape, talk about the school-to-prison pipeline. That is the fact that, you know, young children, particularly from minority communities, particularly young men of color, they don't do well in school. They interact with the juvenile justice system. That interaction leads to going into prison and can cost these people their talent and their lives. And the way we see it is a significant factor in why so many people are falling through the cracks and going from school to prison is because disability issues are not being recognized or realized. One of the co-authors of this report that I worked on is a man by the name of Eddie Ellis. He's a wonderful man who spent 15 years in federal prison for his involvement with the manslaughter and actually spent 10 years in solitary confinement. And part of the reason why he ended up interacting with the juvenile justice system is because he was dyslexic. He struggled in school, and because he struggled in school, he didn't know what else to do. He had teachers who called him names, who said, you're never going to make anything of your life. And because of that, because of disability issues which were not recognized and not addressed, his life took a very different course. And so,
we're just about out of time, Philip, but I'm sure that there's a lot of information that people can get about Respectability from the website. I just had a taste of it today. The website is respectabilityusa.org, correct?
That is correct.
All right. Thank you so much for joining me today. Philip Pauly,
so much,
Policy and Practices Director for Respectability.
Thank you very much. Have a great evening.
Cast on our website at www.disabilitybeat.com or go to Facebook and look for Disability Beat Radio. Please send your comments and show ideas for guests or topics to disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Hope you have a great week.